and Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule to be with us tonight. Tonight I have with us the second segment of Dr. Andrew Rostenberg, and we're going to talk about gut and methylation. How are you, Dr. Rostenberg?
I'm doing wonderful, Eva. Thank you for asking.
Thanks for taking time to be with us tonight. So before we get started, would you just take a few minutes to tell us a little bit about you, where people can find you? And I also want to make sure that people understand, just because we're talking about tools to use to diagnose problems and issues with your health and to prevent problems with your health, Dr. Rostenberg is not attempting, neither am I, by the way, not attempting to treat or diagnose anyone. He's providing information to help you figure out what's going on with your health. So if you have any issues that you think might be related to what he's saying, please see your personal health care provider. Okay. Now, if you would just tell us a little bit about you and where people can find you.
Absolutely. Well, first let me, thank your audience for taking time out of their busy lives to tune into this radio station, because, we need to consistently educate ourselves about the nature of reality, certainly from a consciousness point of view, but, when we get into health and what's actually real, what's true, how does your body really work, those are really critical things that we need to study, and you don't always get it the first time you poke your head in on a subject, and you often end up, a little more confused than you did when you started. But I like to remind everybody listening that, what we're going to talk about tonight is the result of thousands and thousands of hours of work and refinement on my part as a researcher and a doctor. So it's not, it's not something you just pick up and get the first time around. But I would like to, before we get started with much more, just point out that, if you're willing to be confused, you will learn a lot. So everybody gets confused. Some people just get frustrated and stop looking and searching, and I'm going to encourage those listening tonight to not do that. So if you get confused, it's just a sign that you need to keep working, and you'll have your insights, you'll have your breakthroughs, and you'll grow in your understanding of how your body works. That's certainly been my experience. And, who I am, I'm a chiropractor. That was the type of healthcare that got me interested in joining, the legion of doctors out there in the world helping people. I've benefited from chiropractic from a physical and emotional point of view as a younger person, so it had a really big impact on me as a young man. The person who introduced me to chiropractic really made an impact in my life. And when you want to, the highest compliment you can pay to another individual is to be like them. And ultimately, that's the journey that they got me started. That's what started me on this path. But what we're talking about tonight is another branch off this tree of, how to be healthy, how to understand how your body works. And at the end of the day, I am a very obsessed why person. I have to know why things happen. I have, my philosophy is that nothing happens in this universe by accident. Certainly nothing happens in our bodies by accident. So if we see phenomena, we see people getting sick, we see these trends in our healthcare system and people we love and those around us and in ourselves, there has to be a reason why this is happening. So that's the driving force behind all this work. It's just, a bit of an obsession to understand why. The bright side of that, of course, is when people like me get obsessed and are willing to spend thousands of hours trying to figure this out, we can then share this information with the world and hopefully change how everybody else, upgrade everybody else's understanding. So I'm not the world's authority on methylation or natural medicine, but I am a very passionate doctor, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation tonight. If you're looking for more information about my work and my research regarding genes and methylation and how that relates to natural medicine and all these different conditions out there, people are dealing with cardiovascular disease, depression, gut problems, a lot of insomnia and anxiety as well. If you're looking for information on that, the best place to go is beyondmthfr.com. That's a great resource. And my YouTube channel is a very good resource as well. We have about 40 videos and counting. You just go to YouTube and you type in Beyond MTHFR. That will bring up my channel, and you can, you know, stay in your pajamas on Saturday morning and learn some stuff.
Well, I tell you, I know all of those researchers at the top of the food chain, and they're wonderful, and I am so grateful for them. You have no idea. But you make it easy to take, to explain some of their information so that the average person can understand it, and I thank you for that. You do a really good
job.
You're welcome. So tonight what we were going to talk about, oh, did you say your website?
Yeah, it's, so the website is beyondmthfr.com is my...
Oh, that's right.
Yep, that's the website for this, you bet.
I was thinking about the name of your clinic. What is the name of your clinic?
And the name of my clinic in Boise is Red Mountain Natural Medicine, and that's redmountainclinic.com, just all spelled out, redmountainclinic.com.
And do you do any type of phone consultations?
Certainly we do. We have, you know, we meet people all over the world, Spain, Japan, Portugal, Italy, and all across the United States. So we work on Skype, we work over the phone, we've worked with hundreds and hundreds of patients that way. So don't let geography stop you from getting answers. There's no substitute for having doctors in your area for many things, but to understand this niche, to get this information decoded and help make it meaningful for an individual, it works really well from a phone consultation point of view. Absolutely.
Oh, great. Thank you. So tonight we were going to talk about gut, bloating, digestion, enzymes, oxalates. So you want to? Where would you like to start? Do I need to ask you questions, or do you have something that you'd like to start with? Well, I guess I want to ask you one thing.
Sure.
One of the things that I learned in my own life, and I don't even know the whole picture of this yet, so maybe you can enlighten us on this particular topic, is a while ago I started getting really bad bloating right in my upper right quadrant. Every time I would put something in my mouth, it didn't make any difference if it was supplements or food or whatever it was, and nothing seemed to really fix it. And only within the last few weeks have I made a connection between potassium, sodium, calcium, and magnesium, and I still don't have it figured out all the way. But one thing I did realize is I wasn't taking enough potassium. So when I added in a little bit extra potassium bicarb, it relieved a little bit of that bloating out, but it also helped move the things that seemed to be lodged in that right upper quadrant to move it down, which made it made a really big difference in my life and in my quality of life and comfort or discomfort, as it may be, whenever I put something in my mouth. So I want people to understand a little bit about how those things could affect their gut, not just the normal things that people look at. Does that make any sense?
Well, I think it's a difficult question to answer from the point of view of, you know, potassium and these minerals are used by every cell in our body. There are electrolytes. They help maintain fluid balance. They help there's many aspects to these minerals, and I'm certainly not an expert in that area. But, you know, from a basic point of view, we kind of talk about adrenal stress a lot because it's a really big problem. And one of the problems with adrenal stress is you get hormonal adaptations to what your body perceives to be stressful. So you have changes in your cortisol levels, but also in your aldosterone levels. And not everyone is familiar with aldosterone. Most people have heard of cortisol. Aldosterone is sort of the sister hormone that comes out of the same part of the adrenal gland. And aldosterone has a huge impact on your sodium and potassium levels. This is why when we're under an acute stress, our blood pressure goes up because our body holds on to sodium and we actually pee out our potassium, and that's a body's adaptation to raise blood pressure, because we all know, you know, if you overdose on salt or sodium, there's a has a hypertensive, a high blood pressure type of an effect. So there's that, you know, that would be one thing that comes to mind. And then some, there's some information that suggests that, you know, potassium activates the sympathetic nervous system. So kind of going along the lines that when our sympathetic nervous system is really wound up, we lose potassium because of the adrenal hormone response. That's sort of a sympathetic nervous system phenomenon. And then you look at the other side of the coin would be the parasympathetics would be activated or supported more with potassium. So that's, in a general way, you know, one thing that comes to my mind. I don't, in terms of bloating, though, you know, when I hear about bloating, what comes to, what has proven itself to be true more than anything in my clinical experience is that you're looking at a digestive issue where the patient themselves are not breaking their food down. And if we don't break our food down in the upper GI tract, in the stomach, pancreas, and gallbladder, if those areas are not working well, then we have undigested or partially digested food that just slides down into our gut, and it's in a form that our bodies aren't designed to handle. In other words, you know, it should have been chopped up into tiny little pieces because of the enzymes that are released by the pancreas, because of the bile and the enzymes that come from the gallbladder. But when that system isn't working, which is most people most of the time, you have, it's almost like you feed bacteria. So in other words, if we don't break our food down and digest it, something else living in our gut will.
So,
and, yeah.
Let me ask you this question. Don't you, or do you, I'm not going to say don't because I don't know, that what makes your gut contract and relax to push those things out?
Great question. So that's,
if something's off, then it's not going to push out, is it?
Exactly right. So when we're, to kind of articulate the whole gut picture, you know, we want to sort of look at several different things. One thing you just mentioned was peristalsis. It's also called the migrating motor complex. So in other words, you have this wonderful neurologic system called your enteric nervous system, and many of your listeners have heard of, you know, the gut's the second brain and the gut-brain connection, and there's completely valid. So our enteric nervous system is all the neurons and nerve endings and neurologic cells that live, that line the gut. And those are connected to our brain through mainly, the main communication is through the vagus nerve, cranial nerve 10, which is a huge parasympathetic nerve. So if people have a problem with that motility, if they have a motility problem, if they've had a stroke, let's say, you know, I have a patient of mine who 35 years ago had a ischemic attack, had a stroke in their left parietal lobe, and it caused changes to the output of the vagus nerve. And so this individual has struggled with his digestive system. He stopped producing as much enzymes, he stopped producing as much bile, and his gut slowed down. He lost weight, so he has really has trouble keeping weight on, and he gets constipated. So that was basically due, I mean, this guy has a perfect diet, I mean, he's super healthy everywhere else, but he has this brain injury that's changed his gut. So when you have changes to the gut from a mechanical point of view like that, where the movement of the gut isn't working, then you can you become predisposed to A, not digesting your food, but B, not pushing the gut bacteria back down, because for SIBO, which is kind of a common buzzword now, and what I want your audience to understand is that, you know, we're supposed to have a lot of bacteria in our colon, and as you go from the colon towards the stomach, as you go the 16 or so feet from the end of the colon uphill towards the stomach, you should have progressively less bacteria, because we have to absorb our food from our diet. And if we have a ton of bacteria way up near the stomach filling up that tube, that bacteria eats our food before we do, and then we start to see changes to our health that are pretty dramatic. And I'll touch on that a little more in a minute, but to your question, Eva, you know, the movement of the food through your gut is called peristalsis. It's controlled through the autonomic nervous system, and the vagus nerve is the main player. I was just reading an article over the weekend a patient sent me about, actually related to diabetes, but it plays a role in this conversation, is that the vagus nerve uses acetylcholine as the neurotransmitter. So people can develop deficiencies of acetylcholine, And when you have a deficiency of acetylcholine, you become muscularly weak, because that's another, that also is the neurotransmitter that activates our muscle tissue. But the vagus nerve uses acetylcholine to communicate to the gut. So any deficiency of ACH, acetylcholine, can cause, you know, less than optimum signaling to, through these systems. So I think that the article was basically talking about using...
That's interesting.
Yeah. So there's a mechanical component to gut problems, as you've said. And another thing I think is real important for your audience to understand is hiatal hernias. You know, many people have heard of a hiatal hernia. Some people have gone to a doctor, they've done an X-ray, and they can see that the stomach has moved into the has slid up into the diaphragm, and they say, oh my gosh, you know, you have a hiatal hernia, or they've done an endoscopy from through the mouth down to look at the stomach, and they notice that the stomach was in the wrong position. But I want things in this universe and things in our body don't just occur always black and white. It's like this huge spectrum. So on one hand, you have like a perfectly functional, super healthy stomach. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have somebody who has a horrible hiatal hernia. Half the stomach is stuck up in the diaphragm. They're making no stomach acid. And then there's everybody else in between. And I find it all the time. We have techniques in our office to look for it, you know, using kinesiology, applied kinesiology techniques for diagnosis. But hiatal hernia is a very common problem. And it's like living with part of the oven. You know, if your stomach is an oven, this would be that the oven door doesn't shut all the way. And you can get burned, A, or B, the recipe says broil, but the stomach only gets to 200 degrees. Well, you're not going to cook your food all the way.
So what do you do about it?
So hiatal hernias, great question. One of the wonderful things about and a problem like that is it can be treated naturally just by your own. You basically, and again, I'm not giving advice on the phone how to do this. You need to talk to a chiropractor or somebody who's been trained in applied kinesiology, because this fix is super simple, safe, and effective. But you basically grab the stomach, you push into your tissue below your xiphoid process, which is right where the two parts of your ribcage meet, right under your sternum. And you take a deep breath in, and then as you blow you kind of cough your air out at the same time that you push your stomach towards the floor, and that begins to separate the stomach out of the diaphragm. So, you know, that's so this nice thing is you can do manual therapy, conservative, you know, drug-free care, and start to see profound changes in digestion without even using supplements, just treating it that way. So that's something to look at for. Another thing is the ileocecal valve, and that'll be people who have pain in the lower right quadrant. So the ileocecal valve is a huge problem for people. It predisposes us to having gut problems and to having SIBO. And basically what happens is the small intestine and the large intestine connect, and there's basically a check valve. It's a muscle, not unlike the muscle in your bicep or in your calf muscle, but it's a muscle that happens to be connected into your gut, and it connects the intersection where the small intestine and large intestine meet. And its role, as you mentioned earlier, Eva, is that as these waves of muscle contraction come down, the ileocecal valve is supposed to open to allow food to go from the small intestine into the large and then close, so that the food becomes stool and it stays in the stool compartment and doesn't leak back into the kitchen. But what happens is people, again, because of all the things that, you know, your listeners are aware of, that I'm sure we've all been aware of, you know, GMOs and stress, toxins, bad sleep, all these negative side effects that impact our health, it causes inflammation in that digestive system, and it especially causes inflammation in the ileocecal valve. And so what ends up happening to a lot of people is they produce, they can't close their ileocecal valve. They get stuck open and weak. The muscle is weak and stuck open, and so they'll digest some food and slide it into the colon, and then when they lay down at night, it slides back from the colon into the small intestine. They start to reabsorb toxins that they're actually trying to get rid of. So the liver may have to detoxify this molecule of estrogen 3 or 4 times before it's actually out of the body, and that's a huge, huge burden.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So what would you do about that?
Again, that's I would advise your listeners to find an applied kinesiologist, chiropractor, or, you know, naturopath, somebody who's been trained to just, it takes literally 30 seconds on a table to figure out where the problem is, and then it's just, again, it's a massage to that area. Just like you would massage a sore muscle in your neck or a sore muscle in your back, this is literally a sore, dysfunctional muscle in your gut, and it hurts to touch it, but that pain is the pain of healing. And if I advise my patients when we're working on this, they'll have to massage it once a night for 30 to 45 seconds, maybe a minute, for about 2 weeks straight, and then in 2 weeks it's 80-90% better without, okay, just by the,
So just curious, and this has nothing to do with what I planned on asking, but it occurred to me to ask you about the psoas muscle. I know it probably has nothing to do with, and I don't know for sure, but I would assume it had nothing to do with methylation, but sure does give people a lot of problems. Is there any connection?
Well, that's a really good question.
Anything you want to talk about that?
Well, I think your listeners should be aware that, the body has over 600 muscles, and they're now considering, science is now referring to muscle tissue as a system of organs. So they release hormones, they signal with hormones. They're, for all intents and purposes, they're an endocrine system. They're part of our endocrine system. So they're incredibly important. And the psoas is unique because it's the only muscle in our entire body that connects the lower body to the upper body. It's this critical, critical muscle. We work on the psoas all the time. It's related to occipital neck problems. Neck problems cause psoas problems, but we sit. We do not move correctly in our society. We've forgotten how to move. If you watch children learn how to walk, any of your listeners who've had young kids before, you'll notice that they squat. They go up and down and do this beautiful, perfect squat where all they're in line with gravity. Yeah. Yeah, and they squat thousands of times before they can run down the street. So we forget that we've forgotten the most basic movement, like squatting or even crawling correctly, because we've been sitting in schools and sitting at work and sitting in cars and sitting in planes and et cetera, et cetera. So we just, I'm encouraging everybody to move. And if you have to crawl like a baby around your house for a little while, it'll wake your brain up and make you feel better because you've forgotten how to do that. So we sometimes have to have patients crawl.
Isn't it that muscle called the trauma muscle or something like that? Doesn't it have something to do with trauma?
I think you're right about that.
The spiritual I can't remember, but something special about psoas and your trauma or your spiritual life, or I'm not really sure.
Well, there's a relationship, and I'm not an expert in all these relationships. I know the big ones, but there's a relationship between muscles and organs that have been, known for probably thousands of years, but maybe perhaps rediscovered here in the last, 40 years. Your psoas muscle relates to the kidneys and the emotion that affects kidney function is fear. So trauma, fear, psoas dysfunction, that goes along together. The lungs are related to your deltoids, so weakness of the shoulders, a hunched posture is a grieving situation. The liver is the organ of anger. You don't think about, when you hear the story of the drunk who was acting poorly, it was usually the angry drunk, not the sad drunk or the jovial drunk. It's like the kid who's pissed off, the real angry drunk. Well, that's because liver gets poisoned by alcohol, and then the emotion you get on the side effect of that is anger. So, yeah, there's definitely some, and again, that's a whole other universe to explore, and I'm still have a lot to learn in that area.
Okay, well, I know we wanted to talk about, I'll move on then, oxalate. Do you want to talk about that?
I would, yeah, and I'm for the audience to understand, when patients walk into a doctor's office, they're usually coming in because they don't feel well. Once we communicate and train people and they learn that wellness is this thing that you cultivate, after that initial experience, they tend to come back before things are problematic. But in the beginning, when patients are trying to figure out their problem, the reason we seek out doctors is because we don't feel good. And the number one place that we have lots of issues is in our gut. And I don't mean that everybody's problem started out as a gut problem, but everybody's problem, whether it was a major divorce or losing a family member or a traumatic accident or training for triathlons while you're working 60 hours a week, while you're suffering from insomnia and you're only sleeping 4 hours a night and then your body crashes at the end. I mean, there's thousands of different scenarios. What I've noticed in patients is regardless of the cause of the health crisis, or it could have been an infection like Lyme disease or some mold exposure, but they're living in a house where, one of the closets in the back room was actually covered. Everything in the closet, shoeboxes, clothes, everything was covered with green fuzzy mold because the closet was never open for like 4 years and nobody knew it. You know, I mean, that's a story I've heard too. But regardless of the cause of this health crisis, the gut gets the brunt of the injury. And when the health crisis has passed, we tend to think, well, now the stress has passed and this crisis is over, I can just go back and take supplements and eat food and I'm going to get better automatically. And for some people that's true, but for many people it's not. And the reason why is the gut has gotten beat up and injured in this whole process. And even though the gut wasn't where the problem started, fixing your body has to start with the gut. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So I found so oxalates play a key role in gut health, and this is a not something that everyone's aware of. Go ahead.
Why don't you tell them what oxalates are so they
absolutely
know what you're talking about?
Yeah, so oxalates are made inside of our body. Our liver makes oxalates when we're breaking down certain ingredients like cartilage when we eat meat, if we're omnivorously eating, or it's also in produced if we take a lot of vitamin C. And so I'm not saying that oxalates are totally bad. It's always just this balance. But oxalates are also found in plants. And some plants that are really healthy for us, there's an extremely high amount of oxalates. One plant in particular, like spinach, is like off the charts high in oxalates. Beets, I mean, beets are a phenomenally good food. They've got a lot of nitric oxide, great antioxidants, but again, high oxalates. So when we're educating patients about the oxalate issue, what you need to understand is that they're in plants, and they're in the real healthy plants, like I mentioned, beets and spinach and Swiss chard and kale and all these things that people like to, like collard greens, mustard greens, things like this that people are going to juice. And so sometimes people are juicing these foods every day because, hey, I'm making a green smoothie. I've been doing it for a year and a half. I've been doing it for 3 years. I've been doing it for 3 months. Everybody's story is a little different. But what you're doing is you're exposing yourself to a high amount of oxalates. So what are oxalates, right? They're the most insoluble compound in our body. And that's what the science shows us. It's like if they are very, very prone to forming crystals. So they're just completely difficult for our body to keep in a solution. So they precipitate into crystals inside the bone marrow. They can complex with mercury. They can complex with fungal stuff. So, and I don't want to let people's imagination run too far with this, but just understand that oxalates come in the food we eat, especially if we're eating healthy. We get a lot of oxalate exposure in our mouth and then into our stomach. And what this does is it shouldn't bother us. Oxalates shouldn't bother us because our body takes care of it. Now, what's normally supposed to happen when we eat food? Our stomach is supposed to produce acid. That acid mixes with our food, turns it into something called chyme, and chyme leaves the stomach. And as soon as that acidic ball of what was once your food hits the small intestine, sensors are tripped chemically that say, wow, this is really acidic. So I'm going to release pancreatic enzymes. And inside the pancreatic enzymes is a lot of bicarbonate that helps to alkalize it immediately, and as well as releases the digestive enzymes, the trypsin and the amylase and the lipase, these enzymes that molecular machines to chop that food up into really small pieces. But remember, the only way that release happens from the pancreas as well as from the gallbladder, and the gallbladder won't release bile, and the pancreas will not release enzymes if the food leaving the stomach is not acidic. This is just a key take-home point. The chemical trigger for all of this digestive function is that the chyme that leaves the stomach, the food leaving the stomach, has to be acidic. If it's not acidic, then the pancreas does not release its digestive enzymes and bicarbonate, and the gallbladder doesn't release its bile and bicarbonate as well. Key points. And so many people are living with bad stomach function. They have hiatal hernias. They've got a lot of stress. They're not sleeping well. They're eating on the run. They're eating food they're allergic to. Ultimately, what happens is we're eating food, and the bile is not released when we eat. Okay, and that relates to methylation problems as well. So, the biochemistry that we work with shows that when we have a lack of folate or B12 in our body, if we are having high homocysteine levels, if our methylation cycle isn't moving efficiently, we're not producing taurine, we're not producing sulfate, we're not producing the ingredients to make bile runny and thin. Instead, our bile becomes a lot like molasses. So, you know, if you think about getting molasses out of a jar, it takes forever when you turn the jar over, waiting for that drop to come out, whereas it should just run out of there like dish soap really fast.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a methylation connection. People have low B6, they've got low B9, B12, they've got exposure to a lot of estrogen and all these other toxins that they're trying to deal with, and that's just causing their bile to get really sludgy. But this relates to oxalates. I promise this is the connection here. Normally,
that's
when we eat oxalate, I think so. And you know, this oxalate idea is really important because in a normal, healthy gut, oxalates are eaten. You eat your spinach salad with, you eat it with dinner, and the oxalates are released in your gut and they start floating down the tube. Now, normally, what happens is oxalates are supposed to bind with calcium. And you mentioned earlier, calcium, very serendipitous here. So calcium absolutely plays a huge role in healthy digestion because calcium in our diet, and this would be calcium citrate, that would be the form of calcium that will be ionized and released into the gut. If you're taking other forms of calcium or other forms of chelated minerals like, bisglycinate, succinates, arginates, these are going to be sucked into the body much deeper before they're released into their free form. So the citrates are going to dump into the gut. So magnesium citrate, calcium citrate, etc. So
potassium?
I would say that to affect your gut the most, then you'd want a potassium citrate as well. And the nice thing about citrate is it's a supportive nutrient for the citric acid cycle for the mitochondria, and it also helps your kidneys protect itself from stones, which gets back to oxalates. So oxalates are in our food, okay, and they come from our body a little bit, but mainly it's from the diet. So when the gallbladder doesn't work well, we don't absorb fat, right, very effectively. So instead of absorbing fat in our upper small intestine, there's still fat like way down near the ileum. It shouldn't be there. It should have already been absorbed because we should have already released pancreatic enzymes, lipase, and we should have already released bile. So without having that fat absorbed, what will happen is the calcium in your diet from your food, from your dinner, well, instead of binding to the oxalate, it binds to the fat molecule. And then what happens is you poop out your fat, like your fish oil that helps your brain and your cardiovascular system and your heart, protects you from cancer, heart disease, and stroke. You poop that out. You also poop out your calcium. So you start to develop osteoporotic type of phenotypes, type of tendencies. And what you absorb is the oxalate. Because normally, when you're healthy, you absorb the fat first, and then the calcium doesn't bind to the fat. The calcium binds to the oxalate, and then you poop out this unabsorbable calcium oxalate molecule, and you're protected from the toxin in the spinach, and you get all the benefit from the spinach. You know what I'm saying?
I think so. I mean, it's just like so much information with everything else that I already know, and then adding this, I mean, it's like...
So the takeaway is this.
Two more shows or so.
Yeah, hey, it's a lot. I mean, I've been meditating on this and reading this and studying this over and over and over again, like hundreds of times. So it's all learning is repetition. But just know for your listeners that when you have a gallbladder problem, which is the main indicator of methylation issues to me, that's like my main indicator. The worse the gallbladder is, I know the worse their methylation cycle has been stressed in terms of detoxification for a long time. When you have a gallbladder problem, you don't absorb fat well. Instead of absorbing fat, you absorb oxalates. And you poop out the fat and the calcium. It's like you get switched. Instead of absorbing the calcium.
So how do you know which one you're doing?
Well, you know, you can do a stool test. You can see if your poop floats. You can see if you've ever had gallbladder pain. You can see if you've got real dry, flaky skin on the top of your head. You know, people think that's dandruff, but it's really an inside problem. It's a lack of absorption of healthy fats. If you get cracked skin on your heels, like you've got big, you know, cracks deep enough where it bleeds sometimes, really dry skin, you're not absorbing the fats that your skin needs to make itself moist and fluid again.
Okay, so let me just, we don't have too much time here.
Sure.
It's 8:40, so we've got about 15 minutes. So if someone has this problem, and again, we are not attempting to treat or diagnose, we're getting information so people know where to look.
Absolutely.
What would be the first thing, how would someone adjust their diet?
Okay,
whether
great
it
question.
Be with supplements or food, what does somebody do?
We've seen oxalate levels that were like off the chart high, and I should say that the best test for this is the Great Plains Lab organic acid test. That test is worth its weight in gold. Great Plains Laboratory, it's in Kansas, and they have an organic acids test, which is a urine test that will give you your oxalate levels, your neurotransmitters. It'll tell you how bad your gut is infected with bacteria. It'll tell you how bad your gut is infected with fungus. It's just a beautiful test. So it'll give you some other stuff on your B vitamins as well. It gives you about 74 markers. So if someone who thinks they may have this problem or who has an organic acid test to show it, and then you can also do urine tests at a local lab to test just for oxalates themselves. But anybody who has an oxalate problem, it's really quite simple what you do. For about a month, you know, you go on a low to moderately low oxalate diet. So you're not going to be doing green smoothies with kale and spinach and Swiss chard and stuff like that. And you take calcium citrate with your meals. It's very simple. You simply take calcium citrate every time you're eating vegetables that have oxalates in them. And what you're doing with that calcium is you're not taking it to try to build your calcium levels up as much as you're taking it to defend yourself against absorbing oxalates. And it works very well.
So what about people who have plaque issues? How do you make sure that it gets directed there and not into your arteries?
Yeah, there's a... You know, the calcium building up in plaque, that is a concern. But, you know, if you're working on inflammation and you're doing these other healthy things at the same time, so, you know, I've never worked with a patient and just said, hey, all you need to do is take, you know, calcium citrate and you'll be good. You know, we're also saying, well, if you've got this oxalate problem, then it means you've built up inflammation in your system because your gallbladder's become dysfunctional. You've missed out on all these anti-inflammatory nutrients that you could have absorbed. You know, people will have low vitamin D, low vitamin A, low vitamin E, low vitamin K. This will be the pattern you'll see in people who don't just have oxalate issues, but who have gallbladder issues as well. So I wouldn't be scared of it's 100 milligrams of calcium citrate, so that's 300 milligrams total, which is not very much. So you don't need much. I wouldn't worry. You know, the plaquing. Yep, I'd be.
That's it. Okay. Well, we've got about 12 or 13, 14 minutes. What else? Anything you want to talk about in particular?
Well,
I can ask questions unless you have something you'd like to talk about.
Well, I just want to make sure the audience understands. You know, we've mentioned SIBO before, and I want to maybe qualify that to just talk about that it is a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And as I mentioned previously, I mean, it's an abnormal condition to have bacteria in your small intestine that's growing upwards and filling up your tube, growing towards your stomach. You know, some bacteria is good. Having the right kind is essential, but too much of bacteria becomes a bad thing. And so we see a lot of people who've been on antibiotics their whole life. They were born on antibiotics. They use them as kids. You know, it's just the standard of care. So we have adults in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who tell me they've been on antibiotics 30, 40, 50 times in their life. And so this is kind of this wave of people who are dealing with and reeling from what that exposure to antibiotics does to your gut. And so SIBO is one of the big consequences of that. When you start to kill bacteria of one species, you allow the other species to grow rapidly and aggressively. And it just keeps happening over and over again. And so, you go on, that's where the specific carbohydrate diet is very useful. You essentially starve the bacteria you cull the population by not eating foods that are fermentable. I'll be the first to tell you that kombucha and sauerkraut and kimchi and Jerusalem artichokes and all these things that support good gut bacteria are healthy, as long as you don't have an overgrowth of bacteria. So people are reading, oh, this is good for my gut, but I keep eating kombucha and I keep eating sauerkraut and I keep eating these foods and I'm getting super bloated. I don't feel good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you may actually have too much bacteria. Therefore, you want to go into a different strategy for a little while. Specific carbohydrate type diet. It's also called a FODMAP diet. And then we give people.
What? I didn't get that.
Oh, it's called FODMAP, which FODMAP. Yep.
Okay.
FODMAP.
Okay.
So this is, you know, not to. So that's SIBO. SIBO is real important, and it definitely people who have been on antibiotics are predisposed. They're predisposed to this. They're predisposed to being bloated and having diarrhea or constipation for a long time after their exposure to antibiotics.
Would you take any particular kind of probiotic or stay off them for a while? What would you do?
So great question, and one we talk about in the office every day. It really depends on the severity. If some people can't handle probiotics, you give them probiotics and they actually feel more bloated. So that person has to take some time off, 4-6 weeks, do the diet correctly, take the enzymes. So we're always giving these patients, and really almost everyone, stomach acid support to make sure that their HCL levels are adequate when they eat. We're giving them pancreatic enzymes before they eat to help supplement the fact that their body's not making a lot of them right now. We give them bile support when necessary. We use a lot of taurine, a lot of B6, and a lot of green tea extracts.
Let me ask a couple questions there. So you do pancreatin before, HCL during your meal, and what was that?
We do pancreatic enzymes right before you eat. So it's the first thing you should put in your mouth as you sit down to the dinner table. You eat your food, and right at the end of the meal, when you put your fork down and you thank the cook for the wonderful meal and you're done, you should take your HCL at that point. And what that does is it allows your body's physiology to make as much acid as it possibly can before you start to alter it by adding more.
Okay. And so would you take any kind of digestive enzymes with that pancreatin or not?
Well, I should qualify that the tool we use is it's an extract of porcine pancreas, so it does have all the enzymes in it. It has like a very high level of lipase, amylase, and trypsin in there. The pancreatic enzymes that we use are complex with those same enzymes that you're talking about. I think they have to go together, definitely.
Do you use pancreatin or does it have something? What do you use? What is the ingredient that you use so people understand?
What we use is a glandular extract of porcine pancreas. So they basically, under low temperature conditions, grab the enzymes and a little bit of the tissue out of an animal raised for food, out of a pig, and then it's just dehydrated very carefully and then put into a tablet. So it's basically chemically identical enzymes to what we make. You know, so it's strong stuff, and it's absolutely the same stuff that comes out of our pancreas when we're healthy.
Okay. All right. Let's see what time it is. Make sure I don't run over. Okay, we got about 40. It's 12 till. So we have about 8 minutes.
Okay. Sure. Whatever I can talk about to help.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, sure. Ask me anything you'd like.
Okay. So many people, one of the things they say is, oh, I take digestive enzymes. But that's different from what, and I just want people to understand that that's different than what you're talking about. Most digestive enzymes just have bromelain or papain or whatever in there. So I want you to make a comment about the difference between the two. Should they use the pancreatin, or what are they missing out by not using the pancreatin and just using those, I guess, plant-based digestive enzymes?
I'm not sure, you know,
am I making sense?
It totally makes sense. That makes sense. I mean,
okay.
You know, some people are vegan, you know, and they're like, I don't want the animal product at all, and I want an alternative, and
I don't even think it's that. I think people don't understand about the pancreatin.
Yeah, pancreatin is going to be, in my mind, just more body identical to what we make. That's the benefit. So if you want to, if you're trying to support what your pancreas is doing, if you can do it in the chemical the same chemical form that your body makes, then you know that base is being covered. Now bromelain has major health benefits. It's a proteolytic enzyme. It'll help break down your food, but you know. I found best results using pancreatic digestive enzymes to support pancreatic problems.
Does that help your blood sugar as well?
I wouldn't say that it could possibly take some pressure off the pancreas. A good thing to support blood sugar for gut health would be berberine. That's a very good product. A very good tool. Berberine is fantastic. It lowers cholesterol, but it also is a hypoglycemic agent, which helps to, in people with really high blood sugar, it will start to bring that down. It also kills yeast and fungus and bad bacteria. So we use a lot of berberine. It's a great tool.
The reason I mentioned that is because one time, right after I had my heart attack, Patricia Kane at bodybio.com mm-hmm. is her site. She helped draw up a supplement program for me. And my doctor said, man, you know, you're right on the verge of having diabetes. And I have lots of issues at that time. And so she put, one of the things she gave me was pancreatin. And a few weeks later, I went back to this doctor and he goes, what have you been doing? Whatever the labs were for my pancreas and for that blood sugar or diabetes had completely changed, and he said he had never seen that before, and the only thing that I did was added that pancreatin. So I was curious if that could have contributed to that.
I think it absolutely would contribute to that. I mean, if your pancreas, you know, the pancreas is responsible for insulin production and all the blood sugar stabilization that it has to go through, and if it doesn't have enough, you know, on one hand, if it doesn't have enough strength to produce the enzymes and get rid of them into the gut to release them, then how's it going to have enough energy to produce insulin and the other things it has to make? Absolutely. So you're basically giving the pancreas a holiday so it can recuperate when you take these enzymes. So
that makes a lot of sense to me. Okay. Well, it certainly seemed to change my health. Let's see what else I want to ask you about. Oh, the acetylcholine. Let's go back to that for just a minute. How does someone support that?
So acetylcholine, you know, the important molecule there is the choline. And choline is a necessary nutrient. We synthesize choline only one way. There's only one way that we make choline in our body, and that is an estrogen-dependent pathway. It's the gene PEMT, if anybody ever is researching and comes across that. That's what it is, PEMT. And the problem is a lot of people have polymorphisms in their PEMT pathway where if they don't eat choline, they become choline deficient really quick. And choline is a methyl donor. So when we run out of folate, if our body says, man, I need a methyl group now, and there's no folate around to help me recycle this homocysteine or, you know, make SAMe, what it does is it goes into the cell wall and breaks apart a piece of choline to release the methyl group, because choline is very, it's like one chemical reaction away from being called trimethylglycine, which many people have heard of. So choline and trimethylglycine are very similar. So choline is the key part of acetylcholine. And again, people in the European ancestry just have a higher need for choline in their diet. Studies were done, the Japanese and the people in the Orient and in the Far East have genes where their PEMT is going really quick. So they can make a ton of choline. They can eat rice and vegetables their whole life. They never develop diabetes and heart disease because all those carbohydrates can be handled because they can make a lot of choline or they don't get fatty liver. If we did the same thing, a lot of people in this country will, you see what's happening as we eat a lot of carbs. We get a lot of fatty liver and heart disease. So choline comes from shrimp, seafood. It comes from grass-fed beef. It comes from eggs. It's really good. It's incredible. You know, the egg yolk is the most important part of the egg. It's got all the choline in it. And Patricia Kane, you know, in her work looking at, you know, phospholipids and everything, and I'm somewhat familiar with her and had, you know, had some of her protocols help a member of my family. Same idea. I mean, your cells are made out of choline. Acetylcholine is what our parasympathetic nervous system uses to communicate. So that's one way to do it, is to eat more choline. Another way is the herb huperzine. Huperzine is a...
How do you spell that? I've never heard of it.
H-U-P-E-R-Z, I don't know after that. H-P-U-R-Z, H-U-P-E, okay, I'll spell it for you. H-U-P-E-R-Z-I-N-E, huperzine.
Okay.
And huperzine has a herbal it's an acetylcholine esterase inhibitor, which is basically like it inhibits the breakdown of acetylcholine and wonderfully helps raise acetylcholine levels. So,
you know,
now
we've heard of that. That's interesting.
Yeah, we use that for patients who've had, you know, anyone who's neurodegeneration, dementia, pre-dementia, early dementia. It helps to, the part of our brain that fires memory pathways also fires the acetylcholine as its main neurotransmitter. So you can see all these things that we see in our culture have a common source of being dysfunctional.
You just made me want to have you back because I have questions already. I want to talk to you about, I don't have enough time to ask you all the questions, so I'm going to ask this one. What would be any side effect of this? Because people are going to run out and grab huperzine now. What are the side effects or contraindications? And we got about 2 or 3 minutes.
That's a good question. I'm not sure what the side effect of hyperacetylcholine would do. I could definitely tell you what high serotonin would do, or high dopamine, or high adrenaline. I would say that perhaps, you know, I'm not even sure. Not to say that herbs can't be toxic. You know, people who are doing this in an intelligent way, without, you know, taking a bottle per day. I mean, herbs have a way of moderating themselves, so the body will begin to ignore a signal if it becomes too strong. But I just don't have an answer for you. Maybe we see a hyper parasympathetic response, and that's a
possible. Well, I just kind of wondered, is it a methyl donor or a methyl sponge? Would you, you know, because lots of herbs do those things and suck up, you know, your methyl groups or put too many out there, and then you get in some other kind of trouble that you weren't even expecting.
That's true.
I was just wondering about that.
I don't, it could. I mean, it absolutely could. Again, patients just have an obligation to pay attention and to listen to themselves. If they try a new product or a new protocol and they start having insomnia and their pulse goes up 20 beats on average and they start to have palpitations and, you know, their anxiety goes up, it's not that what you're doing is poison. It's just that it's altering your chemistry in a way that your body's not ready for right now. I mean,
watch for subtle symptoms, whatever it is that you do. Subtle changes.
Subtle
symptoms,
absolutely.
Starts some way.
Yes,
okay,
you should see positive changes.
Andrew, tell us one more time where we can find you.
Sure, Eva. You know, curious parties who'd like to reach out and speak to me can contact me through beyondmthfr.com. We have a contact button on there. You can also look me up on redmountainclinic.com. We have our email all over our YouTube videos. I mean, I'd love to connect with you and see, you know, be of service in your journey towards a healthier, better version of yourself and help you overcome your challenges. And, you know, happy to help answer any questions you might have.
Andrew, you've been great, and I thank you. And I'm going to have you back soon. I hope you'll be amenable to that. I have like 10,000 more questions.
That's great, Eva. It's been a real pleasure, and I appreciate, you know, your generosity in having me here, and I'm happy to meet with you again. I'd love to.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks.
Look forward
to
having you back. Have a good one. Good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.